This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Good to have you with us on the program today.
Today's topic is something none of us like to imagine. What happens after we pass away? Sometimes it's, quite honestly, too sobering. But what will life be like after your death? And no, I'm not talking about the afterlife. I'm talking about life after you've gone. Not yours, but your family's. What will their life look like after you pass? Who will pay the bills? Who's going to manage the family's money? Where will the income come from to support the survivors? And who will make the financial decisions? Where will your family live? And will their lifestyle have to change if something happens to you?
Or what if you don't die, but you find yourself in a situation where you're not able to make good financial decisions anymore? Who steps forward to do the things that you used to do for your family? These are all really important questions to answer now so that your family doesn't have to wrestle with figuring out these issues during the middle of a crisis when they're trying to either grieve or care for you.
Now, I've been practicing financial planning, doing it now for almost 3 decades, and I've seen examples of good advanced planning, poor advanced planning for not only death, but also aging. Now, there are a lot of steps you can take to make the legal end of things easier for the people who will end up managing your estate. And, more importantly, for your beneficiaries. And there are steps that you can take to make the emotional transition easier as well. Sometimes we forget about that. Kathleen mentioned grieving. You lose a spouse or a loved one, think of the emotional turmoil that you're going to have to go through. Later on in the program, Kathleen and Tim Prosch, author of The Other Talk, A Guide to Talking with Your Adult Children About the Rest of Your Life, they're going to cover some steps you and your family can take to get the emotional, the financial, and some of the legal issues ironed out before a crisis like death or illness and the impact it'll have on your family.
So I think kind of just to sort of summarize, the point of the show today is really 2 major areas that we find often having a huge impact on the survivors left behind. Number 1 is to get the right people involved ahead of time. And number 2 is to get the right structure set up. And why do we say that these are 2 important areas? Well, Jim and I are going to walk through some examples that we've seen happen, both poor examples and good examples, to give you some ideas as far as what your spouse and your family might face if you leave things in either a good situation or a bad situation should something happen to you. Now, for most people out there, there's usually in a marriage relationship or a significant other relationship, there's usually one of you that's the primary financial brain. There's one of you that deals with all the big money items and one of you that really doesn't. And sometimes the person that doesn't really couldn't care less. I have had clients tell me that their spouses will literally walk away from them when they try to talk about financial issues. So it's not always the case that you can have your spouse be totally on the same page as you when it comes to your financial life. So what do you do to plan for what happens after you pass away if your partner is just flat out not interested in financial affairs? What do you do?
What I want to do is we're going to be sharing a couple actual case studies. We've modified them. In the first case study I want to share with you, the couple was in their early 70s, really just getting into retirement, playing golf, time with the grandkids, the kind of things that you would envision doing when you're retired. The problem was, the husband passed away suddenly from a heart attack. Well, there were a couple issues that come into play. Number 1, there was a living trust involved where the assets were to be split on the death of the first spouse. So you have a survivor's trust, a decedent's trust. And since the estate was worth several $1 million, these are big decisions because really what you want to do is put the assets that have the greatest potential to grow in the decedent's trust, because that's going to escape any further estate taxes down the road. Also, it can provide income. So given that the estate was worth several $1 million, there were a lot of liquid assets. So the first issue that had to be done is, instead of just having one pie of assets, like your living trust, now we had 2 pies, the survivor's trust and the decedent's trust. The situation, however, is that the wife didn't know the sources of income. In other words, she had never done a budget before, never wrote checks before. And initially, she was worried about running out of money. We reassured her that wasn't going to be the case. But she didn't understand about spending principal from one trust in the other. And a lot of times, she would write checks and get confused. She would pay things out of one trust and then end up having to pay the decedent's trust back. Once again, here was a spouse that was not prepared for the passing of her husband. And when it happened, it created a lot of stress. And it wasn't until, I would say probably 2 or 3 years until after he had passed on, where she finally got into a routine of writing the right checks from the right checking account, keeping the assets separate from the decedent's trust to her own trust, and then managing her income. In this case, she was fortunate enough that she had surplus, and so she was building up surplus reserves, and it was a question we'd get together and find out what she wanted to do, whether she wanted to make gifts to her grandkids or add to her investment portfolio.
I think this brings up a really important point, Jim, that, you know, statistically, women are sort of the day-to-day people that pay the bills, do the grocery shopping, and sort of manage the smaller family financial issues. But still, even in Gen X and Gen Y, it's usually the male partner who's doing the big picture financial decisions. And just like with this client, when the husband passes away, the surviving spouse has a really hard time understanding what's going on. They feel confused. They feel overwhelmed. They try to figure out what's going on with the assets, and they feel frustrated. And what happens is that what's already a very emotionally trying time is now just layered with this additional level of stress and frustration and just feelings of not being competent or in control. And so it's really kind of a challenge for people who have a spouse who is just not interested in financial affairs. So there's various ways of handling that situation, which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
This next case I want to talk about, a couple in the late 70s, retired for well over a decade. In this particular case, the husband's health was declining for some time. He had a liver disease. The wife, basically, when he became ill, emotionally, she just shut down, unable to handle the situation. Now, culturally, the wife was not encouraged to handle financial affairs. Her husband did a very good job managing the investments, paying the bills, and making sure that she was taken care of. There was a trust set up. But basically, he was the decision maker. Basically, you know, if she wanted something, she used a credit card. He paid the credit card bills. He paid whatever major expenses. He wrote the checks. If she went anywhere, she had cash or she had a credit card. And the problem was assets were titled in such a way that it took several months for the assets actually to be able to be released to the wife to meet their bills. There was a budget crunch for a short period of time. The one thing, the husband did not like having money in the bank because it paid zero. And so he kept basically the cash balances very low. Well, you know what happens when somebody passes on? There's funeral expenses plus unpaid medical bills that had to be paid. So there was a cash crunch. And it turned everything over to the accountant to handle because at that time she just wasn't emotionally equipped as any spouse would. You know, you have somebody that you've been married to for almost 50 years. You lose that spouse and you have a very close relationship. You can imagine what the hardship is on the surviving spouse.
I think what was good in her case is that she did have an accountant who was very familiar with the family's affairs that she's able to lean on fairly heavily. But again, you know, here she is dealing with just all the things you deal with when someone passes away. And on top of that, just stressing out about money and paying bills is just the last thing you want to do to your family. Now, our last example about getting the right people involved is actually a positive example of someone that we felt did a really good job prepping their spouse and their family for their passing. So we had a couple. They were actually in their early 90s. Very long-lived couple, very happy couple, been together for more than, 50 or 60 years. Just very, very devoted couple. Husband passes away. He'd been a very, very successful businessman, sold his business for a significant amount of money to a publicly traded company. So he was the one that did all the financial decisions. The wife wasn't involved in the decision-making at all. Now, obviously, this gentleman was a child of the Great Depression, really didn't trust banks a whole lot. So he had money squirreled away in several different bank accounts and several different brokerage accounts. And he had assets scattered all over the place. It was a real mare's nest of things to try to figure out what was going on. Now, again, the wife was not at all interested in the finances or the money, had no desire to be involved, and the husband knew it. So when he realized that he was getting ill and the end was approaching, he sat down with his best friend and said, I know I'm getting ill. I know it's not going to be that long before I go. Would you mind helping my wife with our finances once I pass away? And his friend said, of course I will. So the husband took the time to walk the friend through all the investments, all the assets, all the finances, and he prepared a binder for the friend with all the information that he would need to keep on top of the finances once he passed away. So once he passed away, that friend, bless his heart, stepped right up, walked the wife through all the meetings with the financial people, the bank people, helped her consolidate everything. So this particular husband was very blessed in his best friend, that his best friend was willing to do this for the sake of their friendship. And the friend has done a beautiful job of helping the spouse navigate all the financial waters she had to go through once he passed away.
Now, as we're talking about this and you're hearing some of these stories, if you're in a situation, let's say, well, pick on you, the husband, you're making the major financial decisions, you handle the financial affairs. If your spouse is in a situation where she does not have an interest, or let's say, you know, doesn't want to be bothered or doesn't want to learn, you know, you need to do something in advance. You might want to look at a trusted family member, and I mean word trusted, a trusted friend, as the case that Kathleen just talked about, the couple in their 90s where the best friend really helped the surviving spouse, a trusted attorney or a financial advisor or a fiduciary group. And may I suggest, if you have a large enough assets, a corporate trustee, especially if you're getting on with age and the people that you're choosing as a successor are getting on with age too. Because if you name them as somebody to help as either a successor trustee or come to the rescue of a surviving spouse, what if they're not there? What if they pass on as well and you haven't updated your estate plan? Or you have a family situation where you have, for example, kids, where maybe the marriage isn't going that well, or you don't trust one of your daughter-in-laws or son-in-laws. And also, what if they live in different states, different countries, they live busy lives? There's a lot of things that have to be done when a state is settled. And so you need to think about that. And sometimes having an independent corporate trustee as a backup or co-trustee that can help guide the process, keep things on an even level, keep tempers there from heating up, because you'd be surprised what happens when it comes to money and settling an estate. But a corporate trustee is not a bad approach to also add into the mix.
So again, it's really important to have, number one, the right people involved. And number two, to get the right structure set up. Why do we say that? Why the right structures? Why is that so important? Well, especially if you think your spouse may be subject to elder abuse or to financial abuse, it's really important to have the right structures set up to make sure that the possibilities of that happening to your spouse are limited. Here's an example. We had a couple where the husband passes away and the wife was in her mid-80s and she was left as the sole trustee or inheritor of all the assets. So she was responsible for all the decision making with all of the assets. She was responsible for deciding what to pay and what not to pay and who to pay. Now, in most families, this probably wouldn't be an issue. But in this particular family, there were several children, one of whom was more or less a drifter, someone who had never really had a dependable job, someone who was always looking for handouts from the family. So when his father passed away, he decided to move in with his mom. And pretty soon he starts charging things on her credit cards, asking her for big financial handouts. He stops keeping the other family members informed of how her health is doing, both mental and physical. And so by the time she passes away, you know, she had started to lose capacity, but no one knew because he wasn't telling anyone. By the time she passed away, this drifter son had almost bankrupted her estate. So again, if the right structures had been in place with certain types of trusts or maybe a co-trustee with one of the other family members, this drifter son would not have been able to take such big financial advantage of his mother.
This next case is kind of a sad one. It was a short case for us. The husband was in the late 70s. He knew he was dying. His wife was much younger than himself and financially inexperienced, so he wanted to have a trustworthy advisor when he passed away. So the assets were placed with us, and he died about 3 months later. But because of how the assets were titled, this is very important. The wife was the sole owner and trustee of the assets. There was no decedent's trust to protect the wife or make sure his children from a prior marriage got the assets. Well, here's what happened. Wife remarried shortly after his death. New husband convinced her to register all their assets jointly, which he could do because they weren't in a trust. Now, when you put assets in joint tenancy, let's say they're all your assets, you get remarried, you put them in joint tenancy with your new spouse, half of those assets belong to your new spouse. Later, she divorced. A couple years later, the ex-husband ended up with part of that money. And a few years later, it gets even worse. Her son convinced her to put the remaining assets all into annuity because he was convinced by this financial advisor that there would be no risk to any of this. All this money, and it was locked up, all of the assets that remained that she didn't have to pay out to her ex-husband were locked up in this annuity with a penalty rate that lasted for over 10 years. And I'm sure this was the outcome that her original husband did not anticipate. He thought he had things fixed, but the problem he had, and I see this over and over again, he didn't have assets titled properly. They weren't in a protective trust. There was no protective corporate trustee when she transferred title to her new husband after he passed away. In essence, she gave him half the assets under law. And this is something that there are a lot of consequences to this. Seems easy at the time, but there are unintended consequences, as was this case.
Now, on the bright side, let's talk about a case where someone did actually put things in place in advance in a very intelligent way. So we had a client in his mid-70s. He'd been a widower for a long time, and he had a girlfriend living with him at the time he passed away. He was kind of a crusty old retired military guy, but he had this girlfriend living with him, and he wanted to make sure that after he was gone, that she would be able to stay in the home that they had been in together when he passed away. So what he did is that he met with his family before he passed away and said, just so you know, this is really important to me, and so I'm structuring my trust in such a way that enough money will be left for my girlfriend that she can stay in the home, you know, that we're in right now after I'm gone. So the whole family knew that that was going to happen. So when he passed away, no one was throwing up their hands. No one was fighting it because they all knew in advance it was going to happen. And he'd set up his trust in such a way that it did happen. Now, when his son, who was a successor trustee, came in to meet with us after his dad passed, he had this great binder his dad had made for him with all the information on all the finances, all the accounts, all the contact people. And it was such an easy and quick process to get the funds out to the beneficiaries because everybody knew what was supposed to happen. Everyone was prepared and everyone had all the information that they needed. And so what could have been a very divisive situation with money going to, you know, the father's girlfriend ended up being a non-issue because the client had done a really great job prepping his family, not only with the correct paperwork, but with a meeting in advance to let them know what was going to happen and why it was going to happen after he passed away.
So why are we bringing up some of these things? And we're trying to motivate you, if you find any of these examples of case studies we've discussed on today's program are something that you're familiar with, or you may be in a similar situation. If you're a spouse likely to be subject to issues of, for example, financial pressures from kids, maybe you have kids that are in financial need or taken advantage of by your next spouse. Put together an estate plan, maybe an AB trust or some other method to make sure that these assets are protected, and make sure the estate plan accounts for loss of capacity. Because here's another mistake that we've seen happen before, where you have an asset split, but one of the kids is named as trustee. And as we talked about in one of the cases today, where the errant son basically mismanaged the assets, failed to inform his brothers and sisters about his mother's health. spent those assets and didn't inform everybody else. So you want to make sure you handle issues of incapacity and powers of attorney.
And again, all these things are really important in terms of not only documentation. The documentation is only really the first half of prepping your family for what happens after you go. The second half of that equation is actually walking your family through that plan so that when you pass away, your family isn't thumbing through page after page after page of legal documents trying to figure out what in the world you really meant to have happen with your estate. Just having a simple half an hour meeting with your family going over the estate plan, the basics of the estate plan, is extremely helpful, and it prevents a lot of family drama after you pass away. We've seen it. We're telling you, do it now. The reason is, and again, we've said this before on the program, that the gift of an inheritance or a legacy goes way beyond money. A legacy includes making the process easy, making the process smart, making the process follow your wishes so that you have things set up in a way that it's easy for your executors, for your trustees, to make sure your assets get used and passed on the way you intended, and that the people that are involved don't have to go through a lot of complicated processes to get things accomplished. So again, a legacy is more than just money. It's also a gift of preparation and planning for your family.
As we talked about at the beginning of the program, nobody wants to think about their death. I mean, you don't sit around unless you are dealing with a current illness where you're forced to deal with these issues. But part of your care for your family involves planning for death or incapacity in such a way that their life after your death, they are able to move through a healthy grieving process. I mean, think about that for a moment, without the added pressure of complicated financial affairs or estate problems. In the one case of the one couple who she lost her husband, who did not believe in keeping the large amounts of cash around because there was no interest on it, created a problem for expenses, medical expenses that had to be paid, funeral expenses that had to be paid, and that wasn't thought of. Now, if you're having a hard time figuring out how to address these issues with your family, Kathleen and Tim Proch, author of The Other Talk, A Guide to Talking with Your Adult Children About the Rest of Your Life, they're going to talk about ideas of how to start this conversation about health, housing, legal issues, and money with your family. That's going to come up right after this.
As you're listening to us today, have you noticed that maybe your parents are starting to get a little bit creaky? Maybe they're forgetting things a little bit more than they used to. Or maybe you're the parent and you've realized that, you know, you've started to lose your keys a little bit more. Maybe things aren't as clear to you as they used to be. Pay attention. Here today on the program, we have Tim Proch, author of the book, The Other Talk, which is about how to start that tough conversation with your family about end-of-life issues, such as where are you going to live? What's your healthcare situation going to be looking like? How are your finances set for end-of-life? If these are questions that you think that you should be talking about with your family, and frankly, you should be, Tim Proch is going to guide us through a few of the issues facing these families and give us some ideas as far as how to start this difficult conversation with your family. Well, Tim, I wanted to say, first of all, I am thrilled to have you on the program for personal reasons. I went through a similar situation to what you went through with some of your issues with your parents, with my own father. And so as I was reading your book, I was like, yeah, I went through that. I know what that's all about.
Yeah.
And I gave a copy of the book to my mom over Christmas and said, can you please read this and we can discuss, mostly to avoid the same drama I went through with my father.
Exactly.
So would you mind just starting off by talking about what prompted you to write this book?
Sure. I run a strategic consulting business, and what we do is we focus on how people make decisions and what causes people to take action. But we also want to find out why they take inaction, why they procrastinate, why they put things off until tomorrow when they could be doing it today. And for the last 10 years, we've directed our attention on the 60-plus group, what some call the seniors, what I call, I'm 66, I like to call it the rest of my life. And what we wanted to do was get at those same issues. You know, why do people make decisions and what causes them to act or not to act? And one of the most intriguing findings we came up with was that this whole relationship between the adult child and the 60-year-old parent is fraught with emotional intrigue and all kinds of difficulties. And so what I wanted to do was learn about those and find out ways that we could help, in your case, it sounds like it helped you, help people get past some of these emotional barriers and get on to some of the issues that they need to talk about.
Well, I was looking at some of the statistics on your website for the other talk and noticing that the AARP had a study indicated that 75% of parents will just absolutely avoid having a discussion with their children about the end-of-life issues that have to be addressed.
That's exactly right. And one of the early things that we heard was from hundreds and hundreds of interviews with families was, you know, they'd all have a different story because every family is different, but they all seem to gravitate to the same conclusion, which was, I'll never put my kid through what just happened to me with my parents. But in fact, as you point out, AARP has discovered 75% of Americans never have this conversation about all these issues and challenges and decisions that have to be made. And what you end up with is a crisis-driven process where you will probably make lots of mistakes. That's certainly what happened in my family. You're just kind of stumbling around. You haven't prepared for it, and you don't even know what the facts are. And so, again, what I tried to set out to do was help people break that in action, that 75% that AARP has reported on, and say, you know, step through that procrastination. And when you do, not only will it be better emotionally, but you'll make better decisions.
Well, I think you hit on something really important, which is the fact that you had mentioned, I think it was a case of one of your grandfathers
mm-hmm.
who passed away very peacefully, suddenly, in, you know, full possession of his faculties. The reality is that with most of us living longer, that type of end-of-life scenario is likely not going to happen for most of us. And so if we don't sit down with our families and have these conversations, these decisions about how to handle the money, how to handle the health care, how to handle the housing will still have to happen. But like you said, they won't happen in rational circumstances. They'll happen in circumstances when a crisis happens and everyone's in panic mode, reactionary mode, trying to make decisions, often for a parent whose desires they don't know. And it does not lead to the best outcome in terms of decision making or the best outcome in terms of family dynamic.
Exactly. You mentioned my grandfather, and what we began to call that in my family, sort of tongue-in-cheek, was the Rose Garden exit strategy, which, in fact, I was 8 years old at the time, and he would invite me over to see the Cubs game once in a while. And that day, my mom dropped me off. We watched the game. For once, the Cubs won. Doesn't happen very often, as you probably know. So we celebrated with a bowl of his favorite ice cream, and mom picked me up. He went out to his Rose Garden, fell asleep, and never woke up. And what a great way to go. And the problem that it caused in my family was that everybody began to believe that that was going to happen to them. And as you point out, a vast majority of people, that will not happen. There's going to be a lot of issues. My own parents, for example, went south medically, and yet they lived for 8 more years. Mom with Alzheimer's and dad with MS. And we had no idea what their money was. We had no idea what their personal wishes were. At one point, we thought we should put them in assisted living facility. They totally rebelled against that. That was a mess. And so then we finally realized that they needed to be with their social network, their friends, their church members, etc. And that took us almost 2.5 years to figure that out. And then we ran out of money. So, you know, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse because we never talked about it.
What I'd like to talk about just a little bit as far as your target audience for the book, which is the boomer generation, and a little bit why you mentioned you have been focusing on this group in general for the past 10 years, but specifically with these issues about end of life, why focus on the baby boomer generation?
Well, the obvious answer, I guess, is that I'm one of them, are reaching that point where we're starting to enter retirement. We're starting to face what I call the last chapter of life. And it's just the perfect time to have this conversation with your kids. But even beyond that, my parents' generation, you know, the quiet generation, if you will, never would talk about this kind of stuff. But what I'm finding with boomers, and I'm seeing this reaction from readers, is that our generation tends to be a little more experimental. They want to try some different ways of going about things. I think our generation tends to look 2 and 3 decades out, not just to next year. And I think we try to strive for reality and authenticity and not just a fantasy like, you know, the Rose Garden exit strategy. The other reason, which is kind of a scary one, is what I call the boomer's perfect storm. And that boils down to 3 issues. One is that there's certainly more of us. You know, 77 million of us are marching into retirement. Secondly, we are going to be living longer and we'll be needing more medical care. But even beyond that, and the sad part is that there's fewer and fewer GPs, general practitioners, and geriatricians out there. So there's going to be a real battle for good medical care. And the boomers are the first generation to have to face up to that. So it's another reason why you need to sit your kids down now and begin to have the conversation about what's coming.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the title of your book, The Other Talk. I don't think any parent really is excited to sit down with their kids and talk about the birds and the bees. And I imagine no one is excited to sit down and talk about end-of-life issues with their kids. How does one go about setting the stage for that conversation with the family?
I think you need to start by dealing with some of the emotional barriers that you're going to come up against. What I'm finding in general is that there's really three issues that you have to deal with before you can ever start to literally say, let's have this conversation and what are we going to talk about? And those emotional barriers are, number one is denial. Denial of your eventual deterioration physically and mentally and financially. Certainly the denial that you don't want to think about dying, and certainly your kids don't want to talk about that. So that's one barrier that you have to overcome. The second one, and equally difficult, is what I call role reversal, which is when you reach the point in life where you can no longer take care of yourself, and you become the child, and the child becomes the parent. And that's very difficult for both sides of that equation, because the parent feels like they're losing control. The kids are feeling overwhelmed with this new responsibility. But even beyond that, I think there's the shattering of a relationship that you've had with your kids since they were born. You were the parent, they're the kids, and now all that's changed. And it's very difficult. And so I guess I boil it down to when people talk about those things with me and they tell me, gee, I'm losing control, what I tell them is the way to approach the other talk is not about losing control, it's sharing control. And if you can approach this conversation with that in mind, that you are going to be sharing control for the rest of your life with your kids, it becomes a lot easier. The other thing I'm finding with the book is not only with families, but even with financial planners and lawyers and doctors, as you point out, people don't want to talk about this. So what I'm finding, and you did this with your mom, I guess, rather than say we have to have this conversation about, you know, the rest of your life, and then often what happens is the barriers go up and complication begins and you don't have the conversation. But if you give them this book and say, have a look at it, when you're done, let's come back and talk about what's in the book. And so it's almost a third-party transaction where it's no longer between you and me. It's you and I talking about what's in this other entity, this book.
Right. It's like an impersonal third party intervening and sort of acting as a mediator in a way between the parent and the child.
Exactly. And you can argue with the book and say, well, I don't agree with that, but this is certainly a good idea. And essentially, you join together in the conversation as opposed to have a confrontation.
So you've talked a little bit about the emotional preparation that really has to happen, and also just emotional self-honesty as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also, what about the practical side of the preparation for sitting down with your kids about end-of-life issues? What are some of the practical measures you need to be taking prior to having this meeting with your children?
One is that you really need to kind of get your own head around this whole issue, get the right mindset. So you need to, first of all, to yourself, decide what you want to do and what you want to accomplish between now and the end, financially and physically. And that's self-preparation. You also want to realize that you're going to have to deal with this perfect storm I talked about earlier, and how are you going to go about that? And the third one is to start approaching your retirement years with realistic expectations. There was a study done recently where they asked people who are entering retirement, how much do you think your spending will decrease? Do you think you will have enough money, et cetera? And what they found was people said that their spending would decrease 56%. The reality was it's only about 30%. And when they asked them about the amount of money, 64% said, oh, I'm going to have plenty, but the reality was they wouldn't. So that's number one, is get your mindset, get your expectations clear. But once you get past that, it's then, I think, setting the stage for the conversation. And what I would do there is, and this is the practical side you asked about, was to literally create a binder. It doesn't have to be a physical binder. It could be a digital binder, a virtual binder, but a binder that includes everything your kids need to know when they do reach that point of role reversal when they're in charge. And we can go into the details of what's in that binder, but essentially what you want to do is provide your kids with not just a will and a power of attorney and a DNR, but, for example, on the medical side, they need to understand who your doctors are. When you're age 70, you're probably going to have between 8 and 13 different doctors. They need to know who each of those doctors are. They need to know what medications they prescribe. They need to know what the diagnosis is, and need to know what the plan is for each one of those doctors. And so what you're really doing is you're creating this binder, if you will, of all the information about you that they will need. And I wish I'd had this when my parents went south. But all the things they need to understand to begin to take over some of the responsibilities.
Before we move forward, DNR is a do not resuscitate order for those that don't know what it is. Kind of important for people who don't want extraordinary measures taken should they reach a situation where life support might be required, for example. Back to the binder. So this binder, in a way, I don't know if I would call it a roadmap necessarily, but it's kind of like a toolbox where the kids know where to go to get specific information. I was reading through the book. You were talking about three main areas that need to come up in this conversation and the fact that the family has to make a roadmap for each. And from what I understood, the three main areas were money, housing, and health. Would you mind sharing for our listeners some of the primary areas about money that you think should be addressed in this conversation?
Sure. The real challenge here is, unlike when you're saving for college for your kids, when you talk about the money that you need from now until then, you're really talking about financing an uncertain future because you really don't know where the end zone is. You don't know when or where or how it's going to happen. But you do still need to make the effort to lay out a financial plan. And there's a number of programs that you can get from various financial planners or even on the internet that can help you with this. But essentially what you want to do is two things. You want to take a very disciplined approach to the money, the income that's coming in, the cost that you're going to incur. Many people often mistakenly think that their costs will go down, and often they go up. They need to be realistic about that. The other thing that I get a lot of pushback from initially, from readers sometimes, is I always insist on full financial disclosure. You need to tell your kids everything about your financial situation. And oftentimes what happens is parents will say, well, gee, I didn't save enough, so I'm embarrassed to tell them, so I don't want to tell them that right now. Or they can't handle my money, or I'll tell them that when the time is right. And, of course, the time is never right. And so I really believe it's critical that you have an honest approach with your kids and say, here's the situation. Let's together plan the financial roadmap that we're going to take between now and then.
Because the reality is that whether or not you take control of that full financial disclosure, at some point, if you lose capacity, the children will end up having full financial disclosure, but it won't be in a pretty way, right? It'll be, again, the panic-driven searching for statements, calling up financial advisors and banks and figuring out where the money is. And something else I think that I know that Jim Poplav and I have talked about on this program before is that, especially for parents that haven't saved enough, their kids really need to know ahead of time because it affects their own children's financial planning for their futures. Because then the family needs to agree on who and how is going to cover the shortfall for the parents and do that in a way that's not crisis-driven.
Exactly right. And you raise a very good point. This financial discussion you're having with your kids doesn't just affect you and them. It affects the whole family. It affects how they can be good parents to their own kids. And it will also drive you to make other decisions like where you're going to live as time goes on. You might want to live in a real fancy retirement home, but as it turns out, you can't afford that. Or you may decide you want to live in your house. Well, there's costs involved there, too. And so, you know, this is really a far-reaching issue. It's not just how much money is in my bank account, but it's how are we going to manage it, and how are your kids going to get involved in this? Either there'll be some left over, or you're going to have to step up, which is what happened to my family. We were not expecting it.
Well, you sort of brought up an issue with the finances, which had to do with the housing, which was kind of the second main area I noticed you talked about quite a bit in the book. I think a lot of us as children assume one thing or another about where our parents are going to want to live as they age, and that may or may not be what the parents want. Would you mind talking through a few of the issues that really need to come up in that conversation when it comes to the living situation?
You know, selecting the best living arrangement could be an evolutionary process. We know from data that 90% of 65-year-olds want to live in their home right up until the end. And we also know that 90% of that age group will not. They will die in an institution, either a hospital or a nursing home. And so what you need to do with your kids now, while you can still have the conversation, is say, let's talk about what we'd like to do. And let's dispassionately look at each of the options. Living at home is one. Let's, you know, take a realistic look at the house. Probably going to have to make some adjustments, particularly if one or both parents become immobile. In fact, one of the suggestions I make in the book, and I've done this myself, and it's very instructive, take the wheelchair test in your house. either rent or borrow a wheelchair and spend the day going around your house to see what it would be like to live there and what you're going to have to do to make adjustments for that new living condition. I think it's also important, and my wife and my daughter have done this already, is to take a serious look at assisted living. Our daughter has already offered to have us live with her if we need to, which is a lovely, loving thing to say, but that can also be problematical if you don't approach that in a very dispassionate and professional way. We have literally gone to visit four or five different assisted living locations with our family to get a sense of what the place is like. Do they see themselves as running an institution, or are they trying to provide a home for their residents? And there's a lot of things that you need to understand before you ever do it. And what typically happens with an assisted living situation is, let's say your dad goes in, broken hip, and he's got some other maladies, and he comes out of surgery. The hospital says he has to be out of here in 2 days, and you haven't done none of your homework. You have no idea where you're going to go. So what do? Look in the Yellow Pages? You should have done all that homework prior to him going to the hospital. And, of course, you can't predict when he's going to go in. And that's another reason why the other talk kind of forces you to have these conversations now while everybody is still lucid and can be rational about the decision.
Not only lucid, but also it's not as emotionally charged as making a decision that's being pushed by a crisis.
Exactly. Again, that's the whole point of this is, I really think the bottom line to this book is when. Because you don't know when it's going to happen, that means you need to plan ahead. Because if you don't, you know, what we end up doing. Putting my parents in an assisted living facility was a terrible thing for them emotionally. We thought it was going to be great, but we never had a conversation about it because by the time we needed to make that decision, mom lost her ability to speak and dad was having some real mental issues with his MS. And so if we'd had the conversation 5 or 6 years ago, we wouldn't have to go through that.
We talked about the third main area already, I think, a bit, which was health. But you brought up this question about when does this conversation need to happen? Now, in my circumstance, my father started to go downhill when he was 60, in his late 50s, early 60s, which was fairly young. So when you talk to people about when is the right time to have this conversation, what's generally your response to that?
The short answer is now. Don't wait. Just start the conversation now. I'll give you a quick story about myself, which kind of brought it home for me. My wife and I were taking a trip to Italy, and at the end of that trip, we went up to a place called Cinque Terre, which is a lovely place up northwest corner of Italy. One of the days, we rented a sailboat, a great big 30-foot sailboat with a crew, and we went out for the day, and the captain kept motoring around the harbor and not putting the sails up. So I kept bugging him, and he finally agreed. So we went out into the Mediterranean, and the wind came up, and things got kind of ugly, so we headed back in. And it was, by that time, clear to me that the people on the boat were really good refinishers of this boat because it was gorgeous, but they were not sailors. And fortunately, I was. So I told the captain, look, you head the boat into the wind. I'll help your crew take the sails down. And about a minute later, I'm with the crew. The captain's standing next to us helping us with the sails, which meant nobody was steering the boat. That's the last thing I remember seeing on that boat because this huge 20-foot boom came sweeping across, I never saw it coming, and took me out. The next thing I remember was waking up in the emergency room in this little bitty one-quarter hospital, and I couldn't move, I couldn't speak, but I could think, and I remember saying to myself, you idiot, you know, you're writing this book about having the other talk before something happens, you may very well never have that chance.
Window of opportunity might have passed you by.
And you'll never know it. So that's why, because you can't predict what's going to happen in the future, take the action now, today, and you can't do it too early.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned very early on in our conversation today about sharing control. Probably one of the most powerful pieces of information or ideas I pulled from the book was this idea of agreeing on as a family triggers and situations that would drive certain decisions to be made and putting that in writing. Would you mind talking a little bit about what sort of prompted that recommendation?
Sure. I think there's two parts to this. One is that what I think is important is once you go through your first other talk, and I would suggest you have this every year, not just once, but once you go through it, that you literally assign different children, if you have more than one, different responsibilities. So somebody could be in charge of the financial issues, somebody could be in charge of medical, somebody could be in charge of the end-of-life stuff like DNRs and wills, et cetera. And so you know, it's really important that you kind of do that. And knowing it could change. You know, kids might end up with a job out of town, and so you have to kind of shift things around. That's why you want to talk about this every year, because, you know, your health, your financials, your kids' lives are going to be constantly changing, and you need to prepare for it up front. An example of doing something in writing, probably one of the first things that people run into when it comes to confronting your parents over a rule of reversal is taking away the car keys. My attitude is you shouldn't put your kids in the position of taking away the car keys, which is a very emotional issue. It has to do with my own independence and lots of other emotional issues. So what we did was, and we put this in writing, I gave a copy to my doctor, and what I said was, and I do an annual physical, every physical I want you to confirm that my mental acuity, my ability to operate a vehicle is up to snuff. It's not passing the driver's test, but it's really agreeing with my family that when the doctor says, I don't think Tim is able any longer to handle driving the car, that I've already signed off on it. And what that precludes is having the argument or the confrontation that could occur with my kids saying, okay, Dad, we're taking the keys away from you. It's not taken away from you because we are sharing control.
Exactly. This is such an important point that you make here, Tim, because in a way, you are having control of that decision in a certain way because you've already decided the criteria that are going to apply to this huge change in your independence and mobility. You've already agreed with your children what the criteria are going to be. So again, the decision isn't confrontational. It's not emotional. It's a factual event that takes place.
Right. And, you know, what can happen is, and this happened with my dad, because he began to really have difficulties mentally as time went on. I could, you know, let's say in 3 years' time, you know, I love to drive. It's one of my favorite things to do. I could say, you know, I think I'm going to change what we agreed to 3 years ago. Well, by putting it down in writing and everybody agreeing to it up front, including the doctor, that shouldn't happen because I've already signed off on the original criteria. And so I can't backslide, even though I want to. So it's actually a good thing for me, even though at the time I probably don't like it.
Well, I think you're bringing up something else really important too, Tim, which is that for a lot of adults who age, sometimes the mental acuity can start to go. And what that will often do, at least I experience this, is you start to face issues of paranoia on the part of the parent and irrational behavior on the part of the parent. And what I really liked about this idea of having it in writing is that once again, even though your parent may be acting irrational and being paranoid about your relationship with them, you have the comfort of knowing that when they were rational, this was the path they laid out for themselves.
You're absolutely right. And again, it gets down to this whole question of when. You know, and people always ask me, you know, when should I have the talk? And I always say the same thing. It's just do it now. Don't even think about waiting. Because mental states change, financial states change, lots of things can change. And it's okay if you decide as a group to change things. And in fact, you probably will. That's, again, why I think it's really important that you have this conversation every year. Because your opinions on some things may change. Your kids may say, gee, this is not working for me. Let's find a better way. Money's going faster than we thought. And so you need to have a conversation now, today. But also recognize that as time goes on, you're probably going to make some adjustments along the way, but you're going to do it as a group. And you're going to agree that what I call trigger points will cause the children to begin to take charge. And if you put that in writing and you're all clear about when that's going to happen, let's say I'm the kid who takes care of the financial. When do I take over the bill thing? When do I start managing the investment? Those are all issues that my dad and I fought tooth and nail over, even though he was not mentally in good shape to be doing that. But if we'd agreed up front that, you know what, I'm going to take things over at this point in time, a lot of angst and a lot of discomfort and resentment would not have occurred between the two of us.
That is such a great point, Tim, because when I sat down with my mom about the book, what I prefaced it was saying was that I valued our relationship so much and I felt such a great love for her that I didn't want anything in the future in terms of anything that might happen to her to cause discomfort or friction that would cause us to lose the close relationship that we had. And I think that for me, this was one of my big takeaways from the book, is that to keep your family relationship strong and firm and to avoid conflict and drama, resentment, accusations, to have this plan in place does allow the parent and child to maintain a more amicable, loving relationship rather than one that's based on resentment, anger, and confrontation on both sides.
Right. Another way to think about why you should do this other talk is that it's really an opportunity for you to maximize the time you have left together. And if you think about it that way, you know, how can we make all these issues work to our benefit, and how can we do it as a group, and how can we really focus on enjoying our time together as opposed to, you know, have it deteriorate into what you just described, you know, all of the bad feelings and the misunderstandings and the arguments. If you do it that way, I have found, and I've talked to a number of people who have gone through this process, one family I talked to just the other day, they brought their kids in, they did give them the book, so they came in sort of prepared. And they have two boys and a girl. And they said, do you want your spouses to be in this meeting? And their initial reaction was no. They wanted just to be us. And as they got further into the conversation, all three kids said, you know what? We made a mistake. Let's bring our spouses into the conversation. And so they did. And what happened was, not only did they recognize that their spouses were really part of this whole relationship and this whole talk, if you will, the spouses then said, you know what, I want my folks to read this book. I want to have this conversation with my folks, too. Because they began to realize, just as you did with your mother, that this is really a way to, at a minimum, maintain our relationship and maybe even make it better.
Which for me was really the value of the book. And also just about, I tell this to people about estate planning and making sure your estate is in order, that it's probably one of the best gifts you can give your kids is to have a clean estate plan.
Yep.
And I feel that when I was reading your book, I felt the same way, that one of the best gifts you can give your kids is to make as many decisions about your end of life ahead of time so that they're not stuck making those decisions for you, because it's agonizing to do that for a parent.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And you know, the other thing that you might even add to that is, and I've said this in the book, but it's certainly important that you get your house in order, if you will. But I really encourage you, the parent, to take your kids to meet with your financial planner. Sit down and talk to them about, you know, what's the strategy, get them talking so they know when you no longer can be in charge, who do they talk to, and do they feel comfortable with that person? I would do the same thing with your doctors. You know, sit down with your doctors and have them talk with you and your kids about the situation. You know, it just goes back to this whole concept of it's not losing control, it's sharing control. And the more they are part of the decision-making process, not just here's the plan, but they're actually feeling like they're part of the solution, if you will, the better it's going to work.
Well, Tim, I really want to thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today about your book, The Other Talk. Is there a website where people can go, or where can they find a copy of your book to purchase?
Sure. You can certainly come to my website. It's theothertalk.com, all one word, is the name of the book, theothertalk.com. And there you can see more information about the book. You can get a free first chapter if you'd like. You can also buy the book either through Amazon, and you can get an electronic book as well as a hard copy. And you can certainly find it in, you know, every major bookstore in the country.
Well, Tim, I just want to thank you again. I hope our listeners have been taking notes as we've been talking to sort of help their whole family gracefully deal with end-of-life issues. So thanks again for coming and talking with us today, Tim.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm glad that you're interested in this concept and we can bring it to other people.
Great. Well, thanks again, Tim. Really appreciate your time.
Very good. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too, Tim.
So on behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I speak again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.